This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
I want to talk to you today about Nick Reiner, but not about Nick Reiner, okay? Not really. I mean, his name is going to come up in this conversation. This is the reason that we are here discussing this. But this back and forth that we're going to do isn't about him per se. It's more about you. No. Or someone you know, or someone listening to this right now who's sitting in their car in a parking lot because they needed 5 minutes of silence before they walk back into their house and start managing someone else's chaos again. You're not alone. You're not alone. I think that's the first thing that needs to be put across to anyone who's watching this or listening to this going, whoa, ha-ha. I came here to watch this because I'm interested, but also something striking home here. Because here's what I've learned covering this case. The Reiner story is not rare. The ending is rare. God, I hope the ending is rare. But everything that came before it, the years of erosion, the slow suffocation, the way an entire family's life got swallowed whole by one person's dysfunction, that's happening in homes all over this country right now, today. And the people living it don't even know how deep they're in, because that's the whole point. You don't notice the water rising when it comes up 1 inch at a time. And that water may rise 1 inch at a time a day, a week, an hour, a year. It's hard to notice it when it's slowly rising. Nobody wakes up one morning neck deep in someone else's destruction and thinks, yeah, this is exactly how I planned my life. Check the box. Utter chaos. What do I do now? It doesn't work that way. It starts small, a phone call you didn't want to answer, but you answered anyway, because what if this time it's real? What if this time something actually happened? A favor that seemed minor. Can you cover this? Can you handle that? Can you come get me? A lie you caught but swallowed, because confronting it would have detonated an entire evening, and you just didn't have the energy. So you absorbed it. You adjusted. You made yourself a little smaller to keep the peace. And then you did it again the next day, and the day after that. And somewhere in there, you couldn't point exactly to when your entire life, every fiber of your existence became a response to someone else's mood. It's okay. You're not an idiot. It's a slow build. You may sit there and go, God, I'm an idiot. I get it. I've been there. I still have moments I look back on certain past relationships and situations and go, God. How did I get into this? And a lot of times it's a noble cause. It's you, especially if you're a parent, if there's children involved. Most of the time, I would say for a lot of us adults, a lot of us parents out there, it's, well, let's keep stability here for the kids. Let's not blow up the world. Let me absorb the bullets, the pain. And I'm speaking figuratively here. Let me absorb as much of the trauma as I can and think you're shielding the kids from it, and then it'll be all good, right? I mean, it's not. That's never a good answer, let me tell you that much. And the kids that you think you're shielding from it, they pick up. They pick up far more than you think you're shielding them from. If that's your reasoning, if that's why you're sitting in that situation right now going, yeah, but I get it in those moments. And those yeah buts can be pretty strong. And you probably have possibly some of your support system going and saying, yeah, you need, yeah, you know, that's what you should do. Because and it's usually from people who are already in their own unhappy relationships that have stayed in them, that like comfort, that like company with their own misery. Keep that in mind with anybody you're getting advice from. We're going to continue to get into this here, the whole Nick Reiner situation, because it is so relatable to so many people. And we're going to talk specifically about the dynamics of these relationships, what to look out for, what to recognize. If we're speaking to you already, if you're already going, trust me, there's more to come. If you feel comfortable enough, the comment section is a great place to share and hear other people's stories as well. You can do that on our Substack. The link is in the description. It's also on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and you will find us there. Rob and Michelle Reiner were two extraordinary people, two very accomplished people. Rob, one of the most celebrated directors of his generation. Michelle, a photographer, an activist, a woman with her own identity and her own life. And by all accounts, by the end, their daily lives had reportedly narrowed to a single organizing principle. What is Nick doing today? And how bad is it going to get? I need you to understand something that doesn't happen because someone is weak. It happens because someone is loving. That's the sick irony to all of this. The people who get consumed by a narcissistic, manipulative personality aren't the people who don't care enough. They're the people who care too much for their own good at some point. And the person doing the consuming knows that. They've always known that. Let me walk you through what this actually looks like on a daily level. Not the blow-ups, not the hospitalizations or the arrests or the rock through the window, the quiet stuff, the stuff nobody writes articles about because it doesn't make headlines. But the stuff that when you're in that actual situation, kills you. It starts before your feet hit the floor in the morning. You're already running a threat assessment. What's the temperature today? You know the feeling. if you're living with someone like this, you know that every morning you wake, like you may go to bed in a happy place. It may be like, oh, this is a good day. And then the morning comes. And look, this is not normal. This is not healthy. This is not a good way to live. But again, that slow build, it gets you there. And you're like, oh my God, how did I get here? If you ever realize it. And if you're realizing it, there's still time. Because look, for folks, and I'm not trying to be crass here, like the Reiners, it's obviously too late. If you're alive and breathing and realizing there's something very off here with the way you're living, you don't have to be a slave to it. You're sitting there every day waking up going, threat assessment. What's the temperature today? Did something happen overnight in that person's brain that they're somehow then going to project onto me and I have to deal with, and it's going to become the crisis of my day? No matter how much I have to take on, this will then now automatically be the paramount event of the day. No matter how minute it may actually be in comparison to the scope of what actually needs your attention and priority. Is there a text on your phone that's going to rearrange your next 12 hours? Just like a text to just anything, anyone that's going to be interpreted in some crazy way? Is there a comment that someone left on your Facebook page that's going to set them off? Is there somebody that walks by your house that looks at your house when they're walking? What does that mean? I mean, the litany of crazy things that these sort of people will project onto you because of their own insecurities is insane. I mean, I could write a book, and I should write a book, and I should just say here, I will write a book. Is there a text on your phone that's going to rearrange the next 12 hours? Your nervous system is in triage mode before you've had coffee. And you don't even register it anymore because it's been this way for so long, it just feels like morning. It's called hypervigilance, that constant scanning. It rewires your brain over time. Your baseline anxiety becomes so elevated, you forget what calm actually feels like. You think you're fine because you're functional. You're not fine. You're surviving. The Reiners were there. They too were surviving until they weren't. There's the orbit. Your schedule, your plans, your friendships, your ambitions, it all starts bending around one person, like gravity around a black hole. You stop making plans because you might fall apart, or they might fall apart if there's a crisis. So you get sick of, you know, having to cancel plans. Sorry, yeah, so I'm not feeling well. They're not feeling well. Kids are sick. The pet's got syphilis. Like, you start coming up with really creative ideas. Like syphilis for the pets. I meant rabies. Your pet has rabies. Dander. It's dander. You don't even know what you're saying at some points because you're just like, I got to say something. You stop seeing friends because you've had to explain the situation and you're too tired to explain it again. And you're also a little ashamed, even though you've done nothing wrong. You stop pursuing your own goals, not because anyone told you to, but because there's simply no bandwidth left. Every ounce of your emotional energy is going to managing, monitoring, and responding to someone else's storm. And the person causing the storm, they don't even have to ask you to stay close. The anxiety does that work for them. You're an invisible leash. That invisible leash that you are on, it's made of worry and guilt and the quiet terror that if you step away for 1 second, something catastrophic will happen and it'll be your fault. Rob Reiner was making movies that shaped American culture. Michelle was building a life of her own purpose. And by the accounts we've seen year after year, their world reportedly got smaller, not because they chose it, because there was no room left. Nick's needs, Nick's crises, Nick's next catastrophe, it filled every available space. That's not a failure of character. That's what happens when manipulative personality takes the wheel and everyone else becomes a passenger. But here's where it crosses from painful to genuinely dangerous, because someone like this doesn't just control your schedule. They control your reality, and they do it so gradually that you don't feel it happening. It starts with the flip. You bring up a concern, a real legitimate concern. Maybe you caught him in a lie. Maybe you saw behavior that scared you. You come into the conversation with clarity, and somehow 20 minutes later, you're the one apologizing. You walk in with a grievance, and you walk out feeling like the problem. They didn't address what you raised. They redirected, deflected, attacked, guilted, and reversed until you weren't sure what you even came to talk about anymore. And this happens over and over until you stop bringing up things at all. Not because the problems went away, but because you've been trained to believe that raising them makes you the bad guy. Then comes the selective memory. Events you've lived through, conversations you've had, they remember them differently, and they're louder about it, more certain, more emotional. And because you've already been destabilized by months or years of the flip, you start wondering if maybe you did remember it wrong. Maybe you are being unfair. Maybe it didn't happen the way you thought. Your own lived experience starts feeling unreliable. And once that happens, they've got you. Because now you need them to tell you what's real. It's really quite amazing. And then comes the expert discard. This is the one that should terrify every parent, every partner, every family member listening to this. Professionals, therapists, psychiatrists, counselors, people who do this for a living tell you exactly what's happening. They use words like manipulative. They flag the patterns. They give you a roadmap, and your loved one tells you the opposite. Says the doctors don't understand, says the system is broken, says they're the only one telling you the truth. And because you want to believe them, because the alternative means accepting that the person you love most is actively destroying you, you side with a liar. You discard the professionals. You throw away the roadmap. Rob and Michelle Reiner reportedly did exactly this. Michelle said it publicly that the professionals told them Nick was manipulating them and eventually came to believe the professionals were wrong. That's not stupidity. That's not bad parenting. That's the end stage of reality erosion. That's what it looks like when someone has spent years systematically dismantling your ability to trust your own judgment. By the time you're choosing your addicted child or spouses or whoever's worth over a trained clinician, you're not making a rational decision anymore. You're operating inside a reality that someone else built for you, and you don't even know it. And then there's the part nobody talks about, the identity theft, not your credit card, yourself, your soul, slowly, so slowly. You can't point to when it happened. You stop being a person with your own life and become the person who takes care of them. Your hobbies disappear, your friendships thin out, your professional focus fragments, not because they demand it. Well, sometimes they do. But because there is simply no oxygen left in the room for you, you vanish from your own life. And the worst part, you don't even grieve it because you don't notice it's even gone. Let me talk about the cycle, because if you're living this, you know the cycle. Things are calm for a while, maybe even good. You start to breathe. You start to think, okay, maybe we turned a corner. And then the bottom falls out, a relapse, a blow up, a threat, a disappearance. Something breaks, literally or figuratively. And then comes the flood, the apology, the tears, the I know I messed up, the promises. And then the calm comes back. And that calm after the hurricane, it feels good. It feels so peaceful, so much like progress that you mistake it for change. It's not change. It's the reload. And here's the part that traps you. Each crisis has to be bigger than the last one to get the same response. Am I the only one feeling that right there? Who else feels that moment? Who else has been through that moment? Each crisis has to be bigger than the last one to get the same response. And sometimes the elevation of those crises, wow. What started as a slam door becomes a shattered window. What started as yelling becomes threats. The baseline keeps moving and you keep adjusting to what you're willing to tolerate. A year ago, you would have called the police. Now you're just relieved nobody's went to the hospital. And then you're relieved that, oh, they're only in the hospital and they're not dead after they got done playing in traffic on the Las Vegas freeway because their child said they wanted a hamburger. You've been boiled down so slowly you don't feel the heat anymore. Like, what's that? What's it about the law? Who been there? Who done that? I've gotten that call. I've dealt with that. Like what? The person did what? Thank God they're alive. There's breaking points for everybody where you end up having to say no more. At some point, if you're honest with yourself, you can probably pinpoint the moment you knew. You knew this person was not going to change. You knew the cycle was going to keep spinning. You knew that staying was costing you your health, your clarity, maybe even your safety, and you stayed anyway. Not because you're naive, not because you're weak, because leaving someone you love, even someone who is systematically dismantling your life, feels like you're killing them. It feels like abandonment. It feels like the one unforgivable act. And they know that. They spent years making sure you feel exactly that way. They've wired you to believe that your self-preservation is their death sentence. So you stay. And they keep taking. And you keep dying. Reports suggest that by the time the Reiners were living in that final chapter, Nick next door, reportedly deemed gravely disabled, allegedly exhibiting escalating behavior, they were still there, still engaged, still trying. After conservatorship proceedings, they reportedly had more years of crises. After every professional in their orbit had presumably laid out the reality, they were still within arm's reach. Because after that many years inside the distortion field, letting go doesn't feel like survival. It feels like murder. And that's the trap. That's how the manipulator in these sort of situations win. They make your safety feel like your cruelty. So let me end with this. And I'm talking directly to you right now. If you recognized yourself anywhere in the last few minutes here, the morning temperature checks, the shrinking world, the flip, the cycle, the vanishing, I need you to hear something that the person in your life will never say to you. This is not your fault, and you are allowed to stop. Name what's happening, say it out loud. To yourself in the mirror, to a friend, to a therapist, to a stranger on a hotline. Just say it. Because naming it is the first crack in the wall they've built around your perception. And I know that sounds crazy. Just saying it out loud. I already know it. I've been saying it to myself. Yeah, you may have. Have you accepted it, though? I remember just being in a situation, in a relationship, where it was in therapy. And I was not realizing just how hot the boiling pot had gotten around me. And I started to talk about what was happening. And she was pulling it out of me. My therapist was pulling it out of me. And I thought I was just, you know, just talking. You take a step back from what you just placed there on the table, took a step back, and looked at what I placed on the table. It's like, oh God, that's not what I thought I had in my bag. Saying it, it makes it real. And look, if you want to survive yourself, you need to be dealing with reality on reality's terms. You need to start trusting yourself again. Trust what you see. Trust what you feel. Trust what the professionals are telling you. The person you love has spent years teaching you to doubt your own mind. Unlearning that is the most important work you will ever do. And you'll probably still be doing it long after they're gone. And that's okay. As long as you keep doing the work. And understand this, boundaries are not abandonment. You can love someone completely and still refuse to participate in your own destruction. That's not cruelty. That's the only thing that gives either of you a chance. You can't help them if you're destroyed, and you don't deserve to be destroyed by somebody else's chaos. Rob and Michelle Reiner reportedly gave their son everything a parent can give: time, money, access to the best treatment available, forgiveness, second chances, and third chances, and fourth and fifth and sixth and 17th. And none of it was enough. Not because they failed, because no amount of love can override another person's choice to destroy. If you're in this right now, hear me clearly. Protecting yourself is not giving up on them. It might be the only thing that saves either one of you And if nothing else, it saves you. And you deserve to be saved too. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube or on our Substack. The links there in the description. It's one of those, and I've said it before, there's certain videos that we do and certain conversations that we have where sharing is powerful. I think this is probably one of them. We're sharing your story. You know, this is, it's the story, the video of this, the audio of this, where it's going to land in a gazillion places. And folks are going to find this, and they're going to find it to be interesting. They're going to find it to be maybe therapeutic is the right word, but I think relatable. And I think it messages like this and you guys sharing your parts. I've shared my part. If we're all sharing our parts here of our survival, basically, it can make a difference in someone else's life who's just entering this arena. And there's thousands of people every day who are just entering this arena. I think it's our duty for those of us who've survived this arena to let other folks know it's survivable and here's how you can do it. So it's up to you. You know, obviously don't put yourself in any sort of danger by sharing, but if you do feel compelled, share your story in the comments. If you have one, we do greatly appreciate it. And if you're finding our reporting valuable, please do press subscribe, Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. It helps signal to others that that you're finding value here, and then they can find us too. So. It's always kind of triggering when you go down memory lane, isn't it? All right. We'll continue our conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Rob Reiner reportedly called Conan O'Brien before the Christmas party and asked if he could bring his son. Not because Nick wanted to go, not because it was a family affair, but according to multiple reports, Rob and Michelle Reiner were afraid to leave their 32-year-old son alone at home. Yeah. Think about that decision just for a second. You're getting dressed for a black tie holiday party at the home of one of the most famous talk show hosts in America. And your calculus isn't what should I wear or what wine should we bring? It's if we leave him here by himself, what happens? And the answer you land on, the safe answer, the responsible one, is to bring him with you into a room full of people. Because at least there, you can see him. That gap between what Rob and Michelle saw when they looked at their son and what every other person in that room saw is the entire story. This isn't a piece about red flags. Everybody loves talking about the red flags after the fact. This is about why the people standing closest to those flags couldn't read them, or maybe read them and saw a completely different color. Because from inside the world Rob and Michelle Reiner had built over nearly two decades, every decision they made had its own terrible logic. And understanding that logic doesn't excuse what happens, but it explains how two deeply intelligent, deeply involved parents could walk towards a disaster that everyone else could see coming from a mile away. And this is a piece, too, that may be relatable, maybe something you can look at and go, yeah, I've either been there, done that, or it's happening right now, or you know someone it's happening to. Sometimes you can't see the forest before the trees. But sometimes if somebody points them out to you, wait a second, there's a forest out there and trees. Wait, I was only seeing the trees. It's okay. That's how they want it to be. That's how the addict, that's how the manipulator, that's how the narcissist, that's how the borderline, that's how the sociopath wants you to see them. Not as a red flag. No. They found a way to put a filter over your eyes, over a prism that may have already been working just fine through most of your life. But they slowly started staining that. They slowly started changing the tint. And before you know it, that ain't a red flag anymore. Well, that's a green flag. Look at it. You didn't even know it changed colors. Almost like a picture. Stay with me on this one. For those of you who remember developing pictures and them not being digital, where you look at the album after 10, 20, 30 years, they're not as bright. They're not as colorful. They faded. Sometimes the actual color of items on those pictures are different than what it originally was. It's faded. Has the picture changed? No. But it certainly does not look the way it once did. There's only one way to re-see it, through those pictures. If that looks green now, well, geez, it must be green. Until someone points out, hey, that was actually a red flag. Oh, wait, you're right, it was. But that slow fade over 30 years of a picture, you start to question what was originally in the shot. What color was it? That's what these folks are capable of doing. Give me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube and Substack as we work our way through this story. I apologize for the sniffles. It's allergy season. Hiddenkillers.substack.com or hiddenkillerspod.com will take you right there too. Or go to our YouTube and search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and weigh in. This all starts in the early 2000s. Nick Reiner enters his first rehab at 15 years old. It's not going to be the same story again. He's got to kind of establish a little bit here. And here's how the story departs from the template that you've been expecting. Rob and Michelle weren't the absent Hollywood parents writing checks from Malibu and waiting for a phone call that says he's fixed. Danny Sivlar, a kid who roomed with Nick at a $60,000 a month facility, has since gone on the record describing what he witnessed. The other rich kids in that place had handlers, hired nannies, parents who showed up for a photo op and vanished. Rob and Michelle, they were at every single family group session, every therapy appointment. Rob played frisbee with his son's teenage roommate. Michelle sat in circles with other desperate parents and did the work. They weren't just funding their son's recovery. They were present for it physically and emotionally in a way that actually shocked people around them. They're so busy. He's doing all. How does he have time for this? Why? Because his son mattered. Because he cared. Because he loved. All that matters, because it eliminates the easiest explanation that they didn't care enough, they cared enormously. And I see so many morons online that know nothing about this family that just want to spout off and hear their own voice. Well, they were rich, because that seems to be the answer to so many people's failures in life. Someone else's success. Yes, someone else was successful, so they're bad people, right? Is that what they've been telling you? Is that what you've been telling yourself? No, that's not it at all. And if you think that's it, then you are missing the whole damn point. Money has nothing to do with it. They cared enormously. They cared with their time and they cared with their money and their presence. And guess what? None of it mattered. And that caring became the architecture of the trap, because when you're sacrificed or sacrificing that much when you've sat in those rooms, flown to those facilities, written those checks, held the line through the screaming and the relapse and the next facility and the one after that. You can't afford it not to be working. Every dollar spent, every session attended, every sleepless night becomes evidence that you're on the right track, not evidence that the track doesn't lead anywhere. The professionals told them the truth early. The counselors, the addiction specialists, the people with the degrees and the experience, they said what professionals always say in these cases: Nick is lying to you. He's manipulating you. This is what addicts do. Hold the line. Don't give in when he tells you the program isn't working. That's the addiction talking. And for years, Rob and Michelle held that line. They enforced boundaries. They let their son be homeless. Nick has said publicly that he was homeless in Maine, New Jersey, Texas, sleeping on streets, roughing it, because if he wouldn't do it his parents' way, he had to do it alone. It's not easy for any parent. For parents who show up to every therapy session and played Frisbee with their kid's roommate, it must have been excruciating. But then something broke. By 2015, Rob and Michelle had completely reversed course. Rob told the LA Times, and I'm quoting here, "We were desperate. And because the people had diplomas on their wall, we listened to them when we should have been listening to our son. We've heard it 1,000 times. Michelle echoed it. She said the counselors convinced them Nick was a liar, a manipulator, and they regretted ever believing it. Now, from the outside, this looks like capitulation, like the addict finally wore them down. From the inside, their world, it didn't feel like giving in. It felt like a correction. They trusted the system. The system hadn't fixed Nick. So the system must have been wrong. The professionals became the villains of the story. And Nick, the same person who destroyed their guest house, who'd been homeless in multiple states, who acknowledged in interviews doing things like stealing medication from sick elderly people who actually needed it, became the misunderstood victim of bad advice. Here's the mental gymnastics of it. If the counselors were wrong about Nick being a manipulator, then every boundary Rob and Michelle enforced was an act of cruelty. Every night their son spent sleeping on a sidewalk in New Jersey was their fault. This is how they're telling it to themselves. I'm not saying this is what it is. The weight of that guilt is almost impossible to carry. So the only survivable conclusion, the only one that lets you keep breathing, is that the doctors failed you. Not that your son did. You recognize the entire narrative so that the villain is the system and the person you need to protect is one causing the damage. And then you go about your life and you try to correct that damage. And in their way, they made a movie about it. Because when you're the Reiners, that's your modality. Being Charlie, Rob directed, Nick co-wrote it with a friend. He met in rehab, semi-autobiographical, a young man's battle with addiction and his complicated relationship with his famous father. They did a press tour together. Toronto Film Festival, television appearances. Rob called the process cathartic. Nick was more careful. He said sometimes it got overwhelming, but the narrative was irresistible. Father and son healing together through art, the redemption arc America just loves. Except it wasn't. From Rob and Michelle's perspective, this was proof. The new approach. Listen to Nick, trusting him, rejecting the professionals. It had produced something tangible. The film, a shared experience, a creative bond. Look at him up there on the press tour, articulate, engaging, and telling his story. This is what recovery looks like when you stop listening to the people with diplomas and start listening to your kid. This is how they were thinking. What they didn't know or couldn't afford to know is that Nick wasn't sober during any of it. He admitted later on the Dopey podcast that he told his parents he wasn't in a position to do the press tour, that he wasn't a quote-unquote sober guy. He said he'd try to be straight for the talk show appearances, then go smoke a joint on the roof of his apartment afterwards. He told the podcast host his dad knew he was getting stoned but didn't get angry about it. He's a hippie. Nick said the entire redemption arc was a performance. A good one, good enough to fool the two people who most needed it to be real. Because here's the thing about the alternative. If you're Robin Michelle Reiner in 2015 and you accept that your son is performing sobriety while getting high in private, then the professionals were right all along. And the new approach failed too. And you're left with nothing. No framework, no plan, no viable, or no variable left to change. The truth is uninhabitable. So you inhabit something else. Is this making sense? Are you understand? Are you seeing how through their prism, this is what they're seeing? Because I want you to understand how this is being framed. So you can see it through the eyes of the person going through it. And maybe, depending on what's going on in your life or someone else's, it can kind of help you see that too. I hope to God none of this is going on in your life. But I know some folks out there it is. And it's okay if you feel yourself listening to this or watching this and going, yeah, I get it. I kind of saw things that way too. Or maybe some moments you're listening to this going, oh yeah, of course that's how it is. And you're going, wait a second, maybe it's not how it is. In this story, then came along the schizophrenia diagnosis when we turned the chapter in the Choose Your Own Adventure book. Around 2020, Nick was placed under an LPS conservatorship. That's the gravely disabled one under California law. It's different than Brittany's. Eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia, medications tried, adjusted, changed. And for Rob and Michelle, this must have felt like the key that unlocked everything, because now there was finally a medical explanation. It wasn't manipulation all along. It wasn't character. It wasn't choice. It was his brain. Every ugly thing Nick had ever done got retroactively reframed through the lens of illness. The rage at his rehab roommate, the guest house destruction, the stolen medication, the lying, all of it. Symptoms, not decisions, right? It's easier to say that to yourself. And if it's symptoms, then medicine can fix it, right? Finally, after more than 15 years, there was a path forward that didn't require Nick to be a different person. Just required the right prescription, the right dosage, the right doctor. $70,000 a month in psychiatric care. Nick living in the guest house, 100 feet from his parents' bedroom. Rob, who was 78, and Michelle, who was 70, serving as the primary daily supervisors of a man the state of California had once deemed gravely disabled, and reportedly they saw as progress. Which brings us back to the party. Nick showed up in a hoodie at a formal event. He's approaching strangers and asking if they're famous. He reportedly interrupts a private conversation Bill Hader is having. When Hader tells him it's private, Nick stands there staring before storming off. Guests are describing him as freaking everyone out, as behaving creepily. The discomfort in the room is palpable. And then the argument. Rob and Nick get into what witnesses had called a very loud confrontation, audible to other guests, severe enough that Rob and Michelle leave the party shortly after. According to an account later shared at the Reiner's memorial service attributed to an unnamed celebrity by the Daily Mail, Rob reportedly told friends at the party that night that, "I'm petrified of Nick. I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I'm afraid of my son. I think my own son can hurt me." It should be noted that while multiple outlets reported this account, at least one person present at the party has denied hearing Rob make this statement. But it's a party with multiple people having different conversations. And guess what? I didn't hear what they were saying over there, and you didn't hear what they were saying over there. So that doesn't really track. I didn't hear that, so it must not have happened. Kind of sounds like a self-centered celebrity statement, doesn't it? And I went out to dinner the other night at a restaurant that seats 200. I didn't hear what they were talking about at that table over there either. Doesn't mean they didn't have a conversation. But even taking the quoted face value, here's where the framework fractures, because Rob can say those words. He can feel that fear in his body. He can articulate it out loud to people he trusts and still go home. still walk back into that house because in the world he and Michelle had constructed over all those years, saying I'm scared is not the same as saying my son's going to kill me. Nick is sick. Scary moments are symptoms. You don't call the police on a symptom. You manage it. You keep him close. You go home. And you hope the medication adjustment kicks in. You tell yourself this was a bad night. Not a final warning. Every guest at that party reportedly saw a dangerous man. Rob and Michelle reportedly saw their son having a bad night. Same flag, different color. Or maybe no color at all. Or maybe no flag at all. The Reiners spent the better part of two decades constructing frameworks that made their son's reality survivable. First, the professionals were right, and Nick needed tough love. Then the professionals were wrong, and Nick needed trust. Then the illness explained everything, and Nick needed medication. Each framework replaced the last one. Each one felt like a hard won wisdom. And each one kept them exactly where they'd always been, in a house with a man whose trajectory everyone else could see. This is what addiction does to families, not just the addict's addiction, the family's addiction to hope. Every parent in this situation is running the same equation. If I just find the right variable, the answer changes. The right rehab, the right therapist, the right diagnosis, the right medication. And every time the answer doesn't change, you don't abandon the equation. You change the variable. Because abandoning the equation means accepting that your child is beyond your ability to save. And no parent, not the negligent ones, and certainly not the ones who showed up to every session and played frisbee with a roommate, can survive that conclusion. Rob and Michelle Reiner didn't ignore the red flags. They looked at those flags every single day for years. They just believed with everything they had that they were seeing a different color. And that belief built on love, reinforced by guilt, sustained by an addiction to hope that was every bit as powerful as their son's addiction to substances, allegedly cost them their lives. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi or our Substack, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The links are in the description. And if you don't mind, if you have a moment, a review on Apple Podcasts would be greatly appreciated. It helps other folks find our channel. And the couple seconds it takes to leave one, could not thank you more for. So if you got a second, Apple Podcasts, a quick review. Please and thank you if you find this valuable. All right. We'll continue our conversation in the comments. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.